Your Health with Dr. Jill, a weekly conversation about health topics with Dr. Jill Valerius.
Hey, good morning, Dr. Jill.
Good morning, Lee. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Okay, so we're continuing our conversation about Dr. Atiyah's book, Outlive, and this week we're talking about the chapter on cancer, the third of the four horsemen that he talks about. So what is cancer? I'll start with that question for you.
Cancer, I think a lot of people are familiar and have been touched in some way, shape, or form by cancer over a lifetime. And, you know, the title of his chapter is called The Runaway Cell. And so, you know, when we think about cancer, it's another growth in our body, and it's not behaving like our normal self.
Right.
It's not that they often grow fast, but what they don't do is these cells don't die. And when we have cells generally in our body that get old and they malfunction, the cells themselves have a way to basically die, called apoptosis. And what cancer cells do is they don't die.
Okay, so they keep growing, keep multiplying, dividing, and they never die. And they are of our body, but kind of don't really work with the other systems in our body. And it's the second leading cause of death in our country, cancer.
Right. You know, it's really interesting. Over the years, you know, when we look at cardiovascular disease, you know, we've dropped mortality rates, so death rates, by two-thirds since the middle of the 20th century. But cancer, we have not really impacted that in the last, 50 years. Really have not impacted those. We've made some progress against some cancers, so kind of leukemias, childhood leukemia. We've made great headway, but we haven't across the board made as much progress as we'd like. And he talks about different things in terms of what is cancer. And so we can kind of go through, what is cancer? You know, cancer tends to be a disease of aging. The median age of a cancer diagnosis is 66. And actually, though, 6 years ago in 2017, there were more cancer deaths among people between 45 and 64 than there were from heart disease, liver disease, and strokes combined.
Wow.
So we're seeing a huge increase in the number of cancers that we are seeing. And one issue is once cancer is established, we really don't have great treatments. It's just the area we've not made as much progress as we would like.
Right. And I was fascinated to read that every cancer is a little different. Cancers are caused by mutations in our cells that somehow go haywire, but two women could have the same kind of breast cancer, but the genetic mutations are different in both of them. So in terms of figuring out ways to treat them, it's really challenging. It's like you have to personalize it almost.
Right. And I think, we're starting to get there, and he talks about that near the end of this chapter when we're starting to look at these specific T cell therapies and immune therapies. And we're making progress, albeit very slowly. It's very expensive. And I think that is one of the challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Our typical treatment is if we have what you'd call a solid tumor cancer. So if you're thinking about like breast cancer, colon cancer, those kind of things, some combination of surgery and radiation therapy. Like that's just kind of what we've always done. And that's where we are. When we get into metastatic cancers, we're using chemotherapy. And chemotherapy can be helpful, but chemotherapy kills normal cells too.
Right. So initially the cancer is growing in one area, but cancer cells don't stay at home. They appear to roam at some point. So you could have a cancer in the liver and all of a sudden that cancer cells are showing up in another part of the body, and it makes it harder to treat.
For sure. Absolutely. Because once it goes beyond that bound, and certainly if it's a solid cancer tumor, often we can remove a tumor. But once it metastasizes and it gets large enough, or if it's been there long enough, and all these cancers have different behaviors, if they start to spread, then you're down this whole other pathway for treatment and trying to deal with a cancer.
Right. And Dr. Atiyah talked about the 5-year survival rates for cancers, you know, various things. And if you have a metastatic cancer, they talk about survival rates because they don't talk about cures at this point. You don't use cure with some of these cancers because there is no cure.
Right, right. I think that's part of the challenge, you know, and we talk about, you know, once cancer is established, we really lack highly effective treatment. We really have a weak ability to detect cancer at early stages. That's a challenge, detecting things early enough. And, you know, like, so he talks about, you know, his idea, there's, you know, a 3-part strategy for dealing with cancer. And number one, it's avoid getting cancer, prevention. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge because unlike cardiovascular disease, we don't fully understand what drives that initiation and progression of disease. We don't know. And we're trying to make newer and smarter treatments, which I think is helpful. But we also have to detect cancers earlier. And that's a real challenge that he talks about, especially between medicine 2.0 and 3.0. You know, we have these screening guidelines, and we're generalizing to the population. So, you know, what's the best for the population? And sometimes what's best for the population isn't what's best for the individual. And he articulately lays out that while we can screen earlier, he's a big advocate of screening in his patient population much earlier and a bit more intensely. But he also realizes it's costly. There, you know, there's a financial cost, there's an emotional cost, because we start to take a population and how likely is cancer in your population. And if your cancer is very low, we're probably going to detect a lot of things that probably don't matter, might be a glib statement, but we're going to find things that maybe don't matter in terms of your longevity.
Right. Along with false positives.
Right.
You'll get a whole lot more false positives. And it took me a while to understand his balance between, all right, if you test a lot, you're going to have more false positives. And how do you deal with that? On the converse side, maybe you get a lot of false negatives with a certain test. And there's dangers with that, too. And you can't get rid of both of them at the same time, from what I understand. You're either going to have more false positives or more false negatives. Just
correct.
And I guess he would rather have more false positives than false negatives.
Right. And I think many times that's how we look at things. We'd rather have more false positives. Mm-hmm. Than false negatives. Because and what we're saying by that is, like, that means that you do, for a woman who has a mammogram, if you have an abnormal mammogram, 1 in 10 of those are actually normal. 1 in 10.
Okay.
In a low-risk population. And that is not uncommon for me to get a result back on a mammogram for someone that says, oh, there's a spot there, we need additional imaging. The vast majority of times when someone goes back in for that additional imaging, we find, like, oh, that must have been a fold in the breast tissue. We don't see it in another view. And, you know, that's great to get that result. But there, you know, there's a financial cost to that. And there's really can be a big emotional, mental component to, you know, learning that, oh, there's something abnormal. And now I have to go back in and look at this. And you can't put a dollar amount on that.
Yeah. And I guess for him, the trade-off is catching more cancers earlier with this, which is his hypothesis. I don't know if it's backed up by data, that if you do this, you catch more cancers earlier when they're more treatable. So I understand where he's coming from. I just don't know the whole risk-reward ratio, if that makes sense for everybody.
Right. And I think, you know, that's part of medicine 3.0 is sitting down with, and that's what he is doing. He's sitting down with his individual patients, mm-hmm. and weighing that out, which mm-hmm. is why I think it's so important. We have guidelines, which mm-hmm. are great. They help us make informed decisions, but it's so, so important for us each to sit down with our individual provider and talk about the risks and benefits.
Right. Yeah. I think back about, 25 years ago, I had some weird stuff in a mammogram, and I had to have a biopsy, and it was calcareous tissue. And the doctor said it's because I was wearing a push-up bra, and those little wires tend to cause deposits to form that show up on mammograms. And it's like, oh, okay, maybe I should stop wearing underwire bras. It was like, okay. And we know that that causes it and it can cause an abnormality on a mammogram. But it was like, okay, all this because of an underwire.
Right. It to me, it just highlights, you know, like we're still learning there. We mm-hmm. really are. We mm-hmm. we don't have the answer. And once we detect things, interestingly, when it comes to treating cancer, only 5 to 8% of our U.S. cancer research funding goes to the study of metastases. And generally, metastatic cancer is what causes cancer death.
Right.
It's fascinating, maybe startling, and almost sad. Like, we put so little money into that, which, you know, makes it less surprising that we haven't made big headway.
Right. And I'm wondering, Dr. Jill, is if we can treat the cancer before it metastasizes, and maybe that's the theory, then we never have to go there. But then I'm thinking, we don't know if it's metastasized when we start the treatment of the primary tumor.
100%.
So
right, that's a challenge.
Wow. So the other thing that I'm going to switch gears a little bit that fascinated me about cancer is it's the metabolism of the cancer cells is so different from regular cells. And there's perhaps a little bit of ability to discourage them with a proper diet.
Right. He does a nice job talking about this, and he highlights something that's very fascinating, and it's basically this Warburg effect. So in the 20s, there was a German physiologist, Otto Warburg, and he discovered that cancer cells have this ridiculous appetite for glucose or sugar, like 40 times the rate of healthy tissue. But these cancer cells also don't metabolize the same way that we do. And into, we'll see if I can explain this somewhat. So often when we go to create energy, we use what we call aerobic metabolism. So we are able to turn a molecule of glucose into 36 units of ATP or 36 units of energy. And that's under normal conditions. We use aerobic metabolism. When we're under anaerobic, so low oxygen, aerobic is oxygen, anaerobic is low oxygen, under low oxygen conditions, one molecule of glucose only makes 2 units of ATP. And so when do we do that in our bodies? That is when we are sprinting. That's why you can only go all out for a very short period of time. You run out of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So interestingly, these cells love sugar. And it's very fascinating to me and very frustrating to me when we look at the American Cancer Society, how we handle cancer in general in our country. This is a broad statement, so I'm sure it's not everywhere. But I think about cancer suites, chemotherapy and infusion centers, like what's sitting in dishes all around there? Candy. And it's mind-blowing to me because we learned so many years ago, Warburg got the Nobel Prize in 1931 for this discovery, that we know cancer cells take up glucose. They want glucose, but interestingly, they take it all up. They actually metabolize it via that inefficient pathway because that inefficient pathway causes more acid and a more inhospitable environment for these cancer cells. But it also produces all these byproducts that cancer cells can use to divide and create more cancer cells. To come full circle, we know that sugar feeds cancer. That's what we use when someone goes to get a PET scan. We basically inject radioactively labeled glucose into your body, and wherever that glucose goes, that's where we can see where there's potentially metastases or your cancer.
Right. So what it leads me to, Dr. Jill, is that if cancer, you know, if cells mutating and doing weird things happens all the time in our bodies and most of the time we're able to fix it, I think that's my hypothesis. Having a diet that's low in sugar encourages our bodies to like say, oh, well, the cancer cell is going to just starve and die. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. So to go on in this. So interestingly, in the 30s, we realized this, right? So then in 1950, 1953, Watson and Crick and these guys like come up with a structure of DNA, and so it completely diverts all of basically the research. They're like, oh, it's a DNA issue. So like this Warburg stuff, it's just come back into like, oh yeah, we forgot, we learned that in the 30s. So interestingly, we kind of lost this research on this Warburg effect and all this glucose role. We got detracted, and now we're starting to think about that again, because we find like high glucose, which will increase insulin, which will increase insulin-like growth factor. We've learned that these things are playing a role in cancer metabolism. And so now we're starting to see ketogenic diet, fasting, different things that we're learning can make chemotherapies and other therapies more effective. And you actually have less side effects.
Oh, great.
And so super fascinating, but very sad that we had, you know, probably almost a 50-year period of time that we completely forgot.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and I think if we can go in next week and talk a little bit more about some of the new treatments that he talks about. But I think wrapping up this week, like really interesting that we haven't made a lot of headway is the reality of cancer therapy. We're still trying to figure out how to detect it earlier, but also cost effectively. And there's so many nuances because we're dealing with people's real lives. And to be scared that you have a cancer and find out you don't has an impact as well.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Jill.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope everybody has a great week.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.
Your Health with Dr. Jill. It's a production of Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. If you have any comments or questions, please email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.